Well, folks, welcome back to the Fine Wine Confidential Podcast. Fred Reno here, the host. In this episode, number 31, I interviewed Justin Rose, the winemaker at Rosemont Vineyards, located in the Southern Virginia wine region. Their vineyard was planted on land that had been in the family for well over 150 years. I've been impressed with their wine since moving to Virginia in 2019, and I was really happy to have Justin in my studio to discuss his winemaking and the wines that are grown at their estate. There are not many wineries in that part of the state, so I was even more intrigued to get his perspective on what makes their wines so unique. Justin learned the craft of winemaking at Napa Valley College after earning a degree in chemical engineering at the University of Virginia in 2004, an improbable start to what has been a successful career. Let's jump right into the interview. Justin, welcome to my podcast, and I can't thank you enough for taking the time to sit for this interview.
Well, thank you, Fred. I thank you for that very nice introduction, and happy to be here. So,
well, as I like to say, I start at the beginning. What's your story? How did you get into winemaking? And give me a little background on the family farm.
Sure. I did not drink much wine at UVA, so it wasn't that. My family has had the property in Southern Virginia since 1858. Kind of always a struggling family farm. We were lucky enough to, through a family friend, and then he was friends with Lucy Morton, met Lucy in 1999.
Oh, so that's how Lucy came into the scene.
Yeah, from the very beginning. And, you know, Dad, I think, had thought about grapes, because in 1999, 2000, you know, grapes were kind of a thing in Virginia, but starting to kind of increase in potential. So he talked with Lucy for about 3 years. They looked at soil, weather. My dad always remembered that our spot of land on Lake Aston is very dry because of the way the weather works with the lake. We can talk about later. And so him and Lucy were like, Lucy's like, I think we can make this work. And so we planted the vineyard in 2003. I was in college here doing chemical engineering, where I met my wife. And I was going to take a year off, go to grad school for chemical engineering. And Lucy basically dragged me to Napa.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And one of our close friends is John Caldwell. And so I kind of hadn't drank much wine. I'm like 23, and it's like 2 a.m. We're drinking his first vintage of Rocket Science. And I was like, this is pretty interesting. And she kind of convinced John, or they were kind of talking behind the scenes. And John was like, do you want to stay for a couple weeks and work the 2005 harvest and stay at my place? I said, sure. And met some people in Napa College, the professors, and decided to basically, you know, go there and do their 2-year program in a year. Got really lucky with an internship and basically did all of that, lived and breathed wine for, you know, it almost 2 years, and then got back in the harvest of 07 when we harvested our first grapes and started making wine.
When the vineyard was initially planted, was 20 plus acres?
It was, yeah, 11 acres in 2003 and 11 acres in 2004, and then 2 more in 05.
And you have a wonderful cross-section of hybrid and vinifera right in the vineyard.
That's right. We were about half and half. Now, we had a couple acres of American grapes. We had a little Norton, but we had a lot of Catawba. We kind of got rid of the Catawba after a couple of years because it had some viruses and wasn't really. And once we found vinifera would do well, we just kind of focused on that. But yeah, we were about half and half vinifera and French-American hybrids from the get-go.
What's the difference in growing vinifera and hybrid? What's it like, the difference in the vineyard itself?
It depends. If you're looking at like Chardonnay and Chamberson, there's a big difference because we may spray them a third of what we do with vinifera. Vidal, we treat pretty close to vinifera because of some of Pierce disease being in Southern Virginia is an issue. And then also mildew on Vidal for us. So we'll treat Vidal very close to what we would do for vinifera. Traminette actually is now getting more towards like Chardonnay. I mean, like, I think, as Lucy said too, we're a very good example, like Pierce disease, which I think is starting to move a little bit more north. But we've always had an issue with that, or a concern with that. You know, we've lost half of our Vidal over the past 20 years to Pierce disease. And I don't think we've lost a single plant of Traminette, and they literally are right next to each other.
That's fascinating.
So I think it's an interesting little idea. And same with Chardonnay. We may have lost 2 over 20 years.
I will tell you, it took me the longest time to find a bottle of Chardonnay. I was just so intrigued when I learned about it's crossed between Sauvignon and Chardonnay, because right, I'm a big fan of Sauvignon Blanc. And after I finally had an opportunity to have your lineage, it's the best.
Well, thank you. I mean, and we only had a couple hundred plants when we planted in 03, and we didn't really add to it until 2012. Because again, Lucy, we were like, we put in a bunch of test spots. So we had like Hugo White that's gone. We had Vignoles that's gone. So we had Lacrosse, which is from Wisconsin, but we're in the town of Lacrosse. So we're like, this could be clever marketing. Problem is, a grape from Wisconsin doesn't really work in Southside Virginia. So we ripped that out pretty quick. But now Chardonnay's our most widely planted. I think we have almost 5 acres. So we've really gone all in on it. I mean, we do sparkling to barrel aged on it. So all across the board.
So would that area, your region, be considered southeastern Virginia or south central?
Probably south central. Because, I mean, we're right in between the mountains and the coast.
You're really close to the North Carolina border, aren't you?
3 miles. So most of Lake Gaston is in North Carolina. And if you draw a line from Richmond to Raleigh, North Carolina, we'll be right on 85.
Well, there's just not a lot of wineries down there and vineyards, is there?
No, I mean, Virginia Tech had a test vineyard in Blackstone for a while. And then there's a couple other smaller vineyards. We're helping out another vineyard that's just starting up. I think it's an interesting area. I think we obviously have almost 20 years of some data. We also have a unique position of where we're located right north of Lake Gaston. So we do get a lot of storms that come from the west go around us, and it's been that way since the late. It's a man-made lake that was formed in the late 50s or early 60s with a couple dams. And so the fronts will hit Carr Lake, which is west of us near Clarksville, and literally go north and south and then reform past us. And this was that way when my dad was growing up, because my grandfather hated it with vegetable farming, and with farming in general. It would be dry in the summer.
Okay.
And literally, my wife and I live 20 minutes north in South Hill, and we'll get an inch or two more every month in rain than we do at the vineyard. So we have a little microclimate too, which it'd be interesting to see how it factors into other growers in the area too. But we have kind of a unique little position where we're at.
Well, it sounds like it. I mean, it's interesting to me. I will tell you that I've been impressed with all the different wines I've had from Rosemont since I've moved here to Virginia. There just appears to be a place behind every one of these wines. There's an individuality, and they're just really good structure.
I appreciate that. I think it's my father, like I said, went to UVA, was a chemical engineer. Him and I are both very engineering brain. So it's a lot of data, and always I want to have people around me that know more than I do. So between Lucy and my mentor from France, Lucien Guillemet, my contacts from California, and then all the great resources you have in Virginia with now the Winemakers Research Exchange and all the ability to talk to other people, and everyone's very open. And the fact that for us, it's always, we're kind of in the middle of nowhere. Now Lake Gaston has grown a lot, but it was always about the wine. And we sold grapes a lot, you know, for 10 years, half of our grapes. Now we keep everything as we've grown. So we've gone from, you know, about 3,000 cases now to about 7. So we've had this nice, slow, steady growth. And if we need to rip out some grapes that don't work, we'll do that. Luckily, the ones of, you know, big plots of like Cab Franc, Merlot, Petit, you know, those kind of grapes have done well. And so we haven't had to rip those out. But yeah, I think having people around us has helped out tremendously. And the ability and the position to change if need be. So if we have to rip out, like we had an acre and a half of Cabernet Sauvignon when we started, well, that's all gone now. For us, it doesn't work on our site, and we're not going to try to do that. Now we start to see we have a lot more Petit Verdot. We got an acre of Tannat, which I think shows a lot of promise for us if we can figure out some of the spring issues, freezes we're having with it, or frost. But and then like Chardonnay, 5 acres. Five acres of Chamberson, which is our most widely planted red now. Cab Franc will be close because we're going to add on to Cab Franc next year. But and now we're making sparkling with those two grapes, with Chamberson and Chardonnay, which Southside Virginia and a sparkling wine. I wouldn't have thought that, you know. But these hybrid, they have the perfect flavor and chemistry for it in early August that we can do it.
Well, I would tell you, folks, I've had a bottle of each one of these sparkling wines from Chardonnay and from Chamberson just recently. And they are terrific. They are really good wines.
Thank you. I mean, it's been a fun little side project that now is probably going to be a bigger project, which is good. We do a little different. We're doing it in a Charmant tank to try to, one, keep the cost down and try to do it a little quicker. We're doing it with zero dosage and kind of unfiltered. So it's a kind of cool little thing that makes the wine kind of unique.
Let me back up again, though. So when your father retires from Dow Chemical, and he wants to come back to the family farm, was it the Lucy Morton connection that made him think of grapes, or was he thinking about that maybe independently as well?
I think, you know, when he was growing up, he, and again, like I said, it was a very, you know, I mean, he would wake up at 4:30 in the morning, milk cows, you know, wow. Go to school. We never did tobacco, even though we're kind of in tobacco country. The boys, my father and his brothers, would work for tobacco farmers, like as a side to make extra money. But yeah, he worked up the corporate ladder at Dow and worked, and we moved a ton growing up, and he was getting burned out. And he had this, you know, family farm that was just sitting there, and you know, he just wanted to get back there and kind of have that balance. And my mom also is from the same area they met, and dated after in college, but met in high school. And you know, I haven't talked to him a ton about that. I think he probably had the thought of doing it, and then went to Lucy, and then she was able to convince him that this is maybe potentially possible. And that's a big risk for her too. I mean, again, we're in the kind of middle of nowhere, and not a lot of grapes are being grown at the time. So
right, well, especially down there, but right. But it proved to be accurate and true.
I think so. I mean, again, you know, with anything, you have your little struggles initially, but we were able to sell fruit, and we were able to kind of slowly grow, and I think we've gotten very lucky, and then having Lake Gaston and a population base has helped, and so.
So what was the inspiration behind the vermouth project? Because I love this vermouth. Right. So what was the inspiration?
Again, it's these random things that kind of happen. So we work with a distributor based out of Charlottesville, Williams Corner. They've been fantastic for us. And, you know, their owner, Nicholas, was down. He comes down. We'll taste wines. We're talking. We used to do box wines. We've done kegs and things to kind of get our wine out in the marketplace more and just build the brand. And get into more wine shops and restaurants. And I had some extra wine that we hadn't boxed sitting around. And I was like, I might use it. We have some sweet wines that we do too. So I might use it in that later. And he was like, would you be interested in a vermouth? You know, I've been talking with Peter and Kat from Capital Line up in DC and think about maybe working with a Virginia winery. So he put us in contact with them. I sent him samples. Cause again, I make the vermouth, but I very much, again, in that thing of people that know more than me. They do this as a business. They kind of started as a side thing, but they really have a skill in blending and thinking of what to use for vermouth. And so they helped us do it. And now we've partnered with them. So it's a co-partner between Rosemont and Capital Line. The vermouth's been fun. Something now we're ramping up, some fun little side project that now has turned into a bigger project.
Well, I have a bottle in my refrigerator 24/7 and I tap it. It's great as a cocktail on its own.
Yeah.
And it makes for a really good blender down, whether it's some Virginia bourbon or whatever sure. It might be.
Yeah, and it's been fun. We want to keep it local too. So instead of using like sugar for sweetener, we're using Virginia honey from a guy out of Richmond. So, and then, you know, Capital Line's growing pretty much all of the botanicals up in DC and then obviously our wine. So yeah, it trying to keep it again, regional and local.
So you started learning how to make wine in California, mm-hmm. clearly in your career, which is young at this point, obviously. My favorite question to ask every vendor. So what was that one bottle of wine that you had where you went, oh, okay, I get it now. Wine can be this ethereal. It can be this really complex. What was that one bottle? Can you recall?
Yeah, I mean, again, it was with Lucy and John at John's place. And again, after midnight, sitting with them, you know, they're talking about stories of them back in the day and John like stealing grapevines from Europe to bring over to California. And, you know, for a kid that's like 23, 24, and just mesmerized by these stories and this kind of lifestyle. You're sitting in Coombsville, Napa Valley, you know, overlooking all these vineyards. And he pulled out, I think either his first or second vintage of Rocket Science, which I think was Syrah based at the time. And he was just getting ready to start, I think, to make his own wine. He had the nursery. He's kind of getting out of that business and getting into just the wine side. Yeah, just having that piece, because again, in college, wasn't really drinking wine. I wasn't other things. And having that, just like, wow, this is fantastic. And my father's starting a vineyard and I have a chemistry background, which relates pretty well to winemaking. Probably smart of me to maybe put my foot in the door here and see where it leads. So.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, in Coombsville is a very cool growing area in Napa, so I can see him doing Syrah there should be very fascinating.
Right. Now, I mean, his wines, and again, he would always have his vineyard, but then he was doing the nursery. And actually, most of our initial planting, along with a lot of Lucy's clients back then, I think like Boxwood and Black Angle, all of our vines are from Caldwell Nursery, which was great because, you know, you probably know in this day and age with plant material, we had beautifully clean plant material. that now is almost 20 years old, and these vines, like our Cab Franc and Merlot, just look fantastic.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, now that you're getting some vine age on there, that's really going to change the character and the establishment of the vineyard.
That's right.
What do you see in your short period of time, if anything, since the 2007 harvest, climate change? What have you experienced?
It's been interesting for us, and we've actually gotten technically a little colder if you look at, I mean, we're only looking at 20 years. Now, Dad did kind of go back a little bit, too. We have, again, an interesting thing between the mountains and the coast.
Okay.
And, like, this year, now, again, this year probably is abnormal. I was behind pretty much Charlottesville the whole time, which has never happened. And, again, we had another frost again this year that pushed things back. We were very cold in the spring for us. But I would look at the daily temperatures and, yeah, you know, not Northern Virginia is always going to be more behind us, but Charlottesville. So for us, to me, it's just more variable. There's no year it's just always different.
Hmm.
We never had frost issues. We've been frosted out three of the last 6 years. So now we're putting in a bunch of wind machines literally this week. And so that used to not be a thing we'd have to worry about. And we've lost 40% of our crop the last 2 years from frost in the spring.
Well, so that's definitely a change.
Yeah, so it's changing. And I don't know what it's doing for us. I mean, it's just changing everywhere. So it's trying to, we've always had, obviously, on the East Coast, things you deal with, weather, and now we seem to have more things. But luckily, we have 20 years and some experience, so, you know.
Is your father still actively involved in the vineyard?
He is. So that was a big change about 3 or 4 years ago. My uncle was kind of doing the vineyard, and he kind of stepped down from that. My dad was really running the business because a new business and everything with finances. And so about 3 or 4 years ago, it was 2017, he stepped away and he runs the vineyard solely now. And my wife pretty much runs the business. And that's good too, because he's really dope. I think that's how the vineyard is starting to take that next step. Hmm. Look at all the little things, work with Lucy even more. He's involved there. Now, I think we'd love to get a vineyard manager to come in soon, but he would still always be there. And my father's the type of person, he's not going to not work. So he'll be there, so which is good.
I can understand it.
Yeah.
What do you see on the horizon here for, first, let's start with Rosemont. What's the biggest challenge you foresee in the next decade or so looking forward for Rosemont?
We always want to try new grapes because I think Virginia is so young that we don't know everything, which is good. And so we always want to keep learning. So like I said, we had Cabernet Sauvignon, it's gone. We did plant a little bit of Vermentino this past year as a test plot. The reds, I think we're getting more and more honed into. We put in an acre of Mouvedre this year, which I'm really excited about. We had thought we had put in Mouvedre a couple of years ago, and what happened, it was Graciano, the nursery.
Okay.
It was a big thing, the big story that came out for a bunch of people. And so we have some Graciano now as a little test plot. So we have a lot of these grapes that we're testing out and starting to get fruit on, which I think is interesting. Always trying to grow. I think hybrids will always be a big thing for us, and especially now that some of the most widely planted grapes. Well, whites is where we're looking at next, because right now we have Traminette, Vidal, Chardonnay. We have a little Pinot Gris, but we'll probably rip out the Pinot Gris in 2 years. It's been there for 20 years. It's not very good with Pierce disease. The wine is not exactly what I'm looking for in that warmer climate a little bit. And so we put it in a test pot of Vermentino. We're talking about Petit Mansang. Albarino is really high on the list. So again, it's always trying to try new things and see where we go. And then the ones that work well, keeping those and expanding. And obviously sparkling wine is becoming a bigger thing for us. We do a lot of dry rosé. So that's our biggest produced wine. That's 100% Chamberson.
That wine's terrific, folks. I've had it and it is really good.
That's the easiest wine I make. So, you know, if we pick it at the right time with the right balance of acidity and sugar, and I have my little secret on how much I use when I press it out. Because I don't use all of it. It's a direct press, too. It's not on the skins. It's whole cluster in the press and press it out. Because Chamberson has color in its pulp, right? So I can get that nice kind of pinkish color, a little slight orange right away. And then I will watch it and be very meticulous on when I cut the press fraction. Ferment multiple different tanks worth. So first cut, second cut, really hard press. And then when we blend it and literally let it ferment, done, blend it, filter it. So as long as I kind of hit those press cuts right, I don't have to do anything else.
I'm curious about something. So you trained on the West Coast. You obviously must have West Coast vintner friends. What is their view of Virginia wine today as opposed to what it might have been when you left there well over a decade ago?
I think it's good. And it's interesting. And maybe that, I never thought about it until you said something. My closest friends are not in Napa anymore. My two closest people I knew, I mean, Ari is in Israel making wine. He was the assistant winemaker at O'Shaughnessy. And Dave Boss, who was kind of my closest friend there, he's from Michigan, where I went to high school as well. That's probably why we became friends. He's back in Michigan now making wine.
Oh, really? Where at?
Well, he's doing his own thing. So he was really big at Gergich. He was like with their organic program. And then he was actually living on the site there for a while when I knew him. And then he did his own like side consulting business into like organic, natural farming. So now he's back in Michigan. Just happened. I know he's starting to do his own brand, I think a little bit, and consulting in Michigan. And he has his own wines he was doing in California too. So, I need to reconnect with him because we were just up in Michigan visiting some friends a couple months ago. But, so I don't really talk, but I mean, I think in general, yeah, Virginia quality of wine has grown. I mean, the idea of Virginia wine has grown. And I think, I mean, you would know better than I would, but I think the reputation in California of Virginia wines has only grown over the years. I would hope. I don't know if they know a ton about it, but
I would hope it's growing. From my experience, it's a pretty limited growth.
Yeah.
I can tell you that when I sent a good friend of mine a bottle of Norton,
okay,
who knows everything about wine,
yeah,
in air quotes, folks, he was stunned. He'd okay. never had a bottle of Norton before in his right. life.
Sure.
And he was like, this is really good. What is this?
Right. Yeah.
kind of thing,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, that's a native Virginia grape from Richmond that they stole from in Missouri, and everybody thinks it comes from Missouri.
Right. That's right.
but it's Virginia.
That's right. Yeah. It doesn't help Virginia nationally when that most of our wines are sold here.
Well, that was where I was headed with this because what is it going to take, do you think, from your experience, for Virginia to break out of this dome, if you will? And I'll preface this by saying, probably get in trouble here, but that's fine. I'm used to that.
Yeah.
20 years ago, give or take, New York State had that moment
right.
to become recognized in this country as the new, hottest, interesting wine-growing region in the country. And for whatever reasons, and I don't know because I haven't been involved in New York, they never seized it. Mm-hmm. I believe we're there at that crossroads in Virginia right now. And what we do in the next several years is going to determine whether people realize that Virginia is the new, most exciting wine-growing mm-hmm. region in the country.
Right.
What do we have to do?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think you could do a couple hours on this one. To me, you have a couple factors. Obviously, a lot of the wineries, I think, are doing well, being successful. You have big population bases near you. So if you're getting people coming to your winery, you're selling all your wine outdoor, and you're not looking to, like, ramp up production. I don't know if it takes a big brand to come in and put in a couple hundred acres. That's probably the only way you're going to do it, honestly. Or if someone come in and buy a big one and then expand on it. Because, you know, I mean, for like, you know, places like us, you know, we've talked about it. We're at 7,000 cases now. Or we're going to make 7,000 this year and kind of have some backlog. But I don't want to jump much more over 8. If I can do 8 a year, and keep it, because again, our focus is on our vineyard and not sourcing fruit, you know, for our family business. And now I got kids that are 9 and 6 and they're constantly doing this. But so, you know, a lot are probably like us, family, we're not going to be the ones to do it. We're going to try to make the best wine we can. I'll be honest, the best wine we can. And if I get brand recognition from outside the region, because we're distributed in a couple states, but I'm not the one that, you know, and a lot like me are not going to be the one to do these. Probably make it national. So yeah, I think you probably, I mean, you think of Charlottesville and this area, if you have someone come in and buy and do a 400 acre track and throw all, you know, put it all in. But now again, you have these weather things more of an issue. And
well, you know, I tell people, think about Virginia like you think about France. And by that, I mean, they don't grow Pinot Noir in Bordeaux and they don't grow Cabernet Sauvignon in Burgundy. And there's just certain areas and regions in France that do much better with certain varietals.
Right.
That's what Virginia looks like to me. You just have a diversity here.
Right. And it's, yes. And yeah, and you have so many, and I do think it's not a bad thing, but you have so much experimentation and trying new varieties. And so, yeah, if you put in the, you know, you had Petit Mansang that started to kind of grow in popularity, but no one's come in and put like a huge track of that in, you know? So yeah, that's a question. Do you try to pick one or two grapes for one of those producers that that's what they're going to make, and you're going to make 40,000 cases of Cab Franc and put it out there again? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's a...
Well, I think that's... I agree with you, Justin. That's what it's going to take. Some people are scared by the notion of some big player with a lot of capital,
yeah,
a lot of experience, the distribution clout,
yeah,
to come in here. But that is going to... All the old saying, all rising tide raises all boats.
Boats, right.
It does do that. Okay. I mean, if you look at Oregon, when Drew Ann went there, everybody said, what are you doing? Now, today, and recently, in the last decade, Oregon was the hottest wine-growing region, yep, in the country.
Yep.
And that's what it's going to take. But I don't see it as a threat. I see it as a positive for Virginia because it will help the entire industry. I had some people say, well, you know, I only make 500 cases. And I'll say, well, do you realize that some of the greatest wines in the world are only made in 500 case, sure, lots? And everybody in the world knows about them and, right, wants to buy them.
Right.
I think that, this is my opinion again, but I believe that's important to the long-term viability of the Virginia wine industry to have a global recognition to where people go, oh, it's part of what I want to experiment. I want to understand Virginia wine.
Right.
Because if we're all selling to the same people.
Right. No, I think that's right. And yeah, you're exactly right. But yeah, you can have a small case, some production of something really good and build the brand that way too. So, and I do agree. I mean, I think I've been involved since 2007. So yeah, some of the bigger wineries that have had some distribution and built the brand, I've heard both sides of that. A rising tide lifts all boats. I think it's right though. If you don't want to get on that tide and go with it, that's on you. But if they're going to break some of those barriers, that's fantastic. And that has happened with some of the wineries and through distribution and their quality of wine and their recognition and stuff. And so, you know, and again, for us, it's always been about the wine. So I can kind of sit down there in Southside Virginia and try to do what we do and just trying to slowly build on what we're doing, which has been nice. And that my father has given me the ability because my father, basically, when I got back from Napa, because my dad was always about the vineyard first. He wanted to do something with the land. He drinks wine a little bit, but it's not about the wine for him. It's about the passion of using the land that he grew up on that's been the family for years and growing the grapes and farming and the whole soil and all that kumbaya stuff. I mean, my dad, that's what he does. So, but for me, yeah, just the fact that he was just like, here's a 25-year-old, go make wine. It was a kind of a risky thing for him, but I think hopefully it's worked out for us. So,
well, I'd say the results that you have put out there speak loudly. The quality is there. There's absolutely no question about that.
I appreciate that.
You know, and I can't imagine the future not being bright. And you got a family, so there's a,
yeah,
at some point there's a generational,
yeah,
pass, yeah, here.
I think so. I mean, that's what we hope. I won't push them too hard, but if they're interested, 100%. I mean, my son, who's 9, is already, we're bottling our next sparkling wine on Friday, and he wanted me to do it instead of Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, so he can help on Saturday.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, he also wants to get paid, which is fine. I appreciate that. I appreciate that game. We're very lucky that my parents are right there, obviously, and my wife's parents are in D.C., but they're down all the time. And so we have that.
Well, your wife, Aubrey, is very intimately involved in,
yes,
in the operation. That's, she's right, running the business.
She's been with us now, I think, almost 10 years. So we met at UVA. She was in the comm school. She was working in D.C. We didn't start dating until after college, right before I went to Napa. And we were friends, though, all through college. And she was working for Adobe and Symantec, so she would come visit me out when I was in Napa. She was working for that tech company in D.C. and then moved down to Southside, Virginia. We got married in 2009. But after about 2.5-3 years, my dad and I couldn't keep, it wasn't going to, Rosemont was not going to grow without someone there. And she had the marketing background and stuff. So yeah, so she's been with us now almost 10 years. And basically, like I said, dad now has taken over the vineyard and Aubrey pretty much keeps us all in line.
Well, she's on the Virginia Wine Board now.
She is. Yes. Yeah.
So were you on the Virginia Wine Board?
I'm on the Wineries Association board, and I was president of the Wineries Association.
Wineries Association.
That's right.
You know,
so
I'm curious about the Virginia Wineries Association. What's its number one mission?
So there's always been kind of confusion, too, because you have all these different associations. So you had the Vineyards Association, makes sense, mostly vineyards. Wineries, going to be mostly wineries, but like years ago, it was mostly they did Vintage Virginia Wine Festival. That was kind of their thing. That's where they made the money. And then they were part, and now the Wineries Association doesn't, well, actually, we're not going to have that anymore, I don't think. So it's more of promoting Virginia wine. Really, really, I think been really important through COVID, because we were doing multiple meetings a week at times just to like keep people up to date. You also have the legislative forum of it, which hopefully for people listening to the industry, I would encourage to help out as much as you can because there's always legislative issues. So we do a little bit with that, but there's also a legislative group that does that too. So we have all these different things. Then you have the wine board. Now the wine board is all the excise tax money appropriated from the governor. And so that is what now Aubrey is on. And so that appropriates money for research, marketing, all that stuff, which I think, you know, I was talking to friends of mine in Maryland. I think they're very jealous of that. That's an amazing thing that we have, you know, to just promote Virginia wine and educate. And so we have all these systems. You have the resource exchange. So we're doing all this testing between winemakers doing projects and talking about what they're doing. There's so many outlets. It gets a little confusing, but it's all good in the end.
Are you involved at all with the winemakers research exchange?
A little bit. I wish I was more, but I think when I had to be, when I was president of the winery association, I used to do a lot more. I want to get back into doing, I did a lot of trials. So I'd like to get back into doing more. I try to participate in all of them because you're always learning something on these things. So you get to taste people's trials and talk about what they're doing and stuff. So I've been a little bit involved, but not as much as if they're willing, I would love to be more involved, but I think they have a really good group that's doing a lot of good work with that. So.
Yeah, no, it sounds like that's critical, and that filled that void. Bruce Socklin retired. All of a sudden, there was this void, and they came in and filled that.
That's right. And a great idea that again, a lot of these things, some not all of them, but some started in Charlottesville with winemakers getting together as a group and then going to the wine board and getting grants and funding. So again, all these things that are set up that if you utilize can really help out the industry. So.
Fascinating.
Yep.
Fascinating. Well, Justin, I've enjoyed our time here.
I appreciate
morning.
It. Yeah.
This has been,
it's been fun.
To get a what I'm going to call a younger, energetic viewpoint of what is happening here, but yet somebody with well over a decade plus experience.
I appreciate the younger because I turned 40 next week. So I appreciate you saying younger because I'm, you know.
Well, but. That's kind of, you know, I just turned 70, so I can tell you, you don't want to be 70, but in any event, we've had a nice glass of Chablis.
Yes.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Well, folks, if you couldn't tell, I am a big fan of Rosemont's wines and recommend them to you to try for yourself. They're among the finest being produced here in Virginia, in my opinion, and Justin has showed an ability to translate a sense of place into wines from his family farm. In my next upcoming episode, number 32, I interview Mike Henney. Now, Mike, in his 30-year career, has worked side-by-side with several of the most notable vintners, starting with Archie Smith at Meredith Vineyards, then Shep Ross at Mount Domain Cellars, and then working with Alan Kinney and Dennis Horton at Horton Vineyards. He would eventually return to the Mount Domain facility. However, it is now the home of Michael Schaff's Wineworks, where Mike is in charge of overseeing the production operation, not just for Michael Schaff's wines, but the dozen or more contract clients that they produce wine for. Mike is a very reflective individual and shares his interesting perspective about wine growing in Virginia, adding another dimension to the story I'm telling about the Virginia modern day wine history. Stay tuned for that episode. As always, thank you for being a listener. And if you have any questions or comments, send them to me at fred@finewineconfidential.com. See you on the other side. Music at Fine Wine Confidential podcast by Jason Shaw at audionautics.com from his copyrighted song Acoustic Shuffle under Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License. I hope you enjoyed the show.